welcome to this special edition of Cultural Baggage. My name is Dean Becker. Our guests on this program are the noted chemist Sasha Shulgin and his wife Anne. Please join us as we endeavor to present the unvarnished truth about the war on drugs.
Joining us on this edition are Alexander Shulgin, he likes to be called Sasha, the noted chemist, and his wife Anne, a researcher and lay therapist, and Sasha's sometimes co-author. Sasha and Anne, welcome to Cultural Baggage.
It's a total pleasure to be here.
Hello, Dean.
Thank you for joining us. Sasha, a quote I picked up from your online column that's available at cognitiveliberty.org talks about how, in order to do studies of drugs, one must jump through nearly a dozen hoops involving the DEA, the FDA, and many others, and how, quote, in California, approval has to be obtained for your submitted research protocol from the group formerly called the California Research Advisory Panel, end quote. Now, they subsequently removed the letter C to change the acronym, but, sir, are these laws not unconstitutional and just plain crap?
Well, that's a loaded question. The thing is, the laws are there primarily to protect people from not well thought out human experimentation. This is with drug houses, with pharmaceutical houses, with academic environment, and there is this research advisory panel that evaluates the protocol of the experiment that is intended. It is, however, perfectly legal to experiment as you wish, as long as you are taking the responsibility of what may happen and you are not violating any law.
The situation involving, if you will, trade-offs back and forth between the FDA, the DEA, people moving into the pharmaceutical houses and back, and these people many times do not have the controls in place to protect us, do they?
Well, a lot of times the people who do early phase experiments with the FDA approval and DEA approval are doing it aiming toward a research product that can be sold, a material that has a medical value. None of this is research. The research is there. But the work that I'm involved with and Anne is involved with is research into discovering new things, not making commercially available things that could be used for revenue, but to make new things that will give new ideas for people who are in this area of research.
I know oft times in the past you had created some of these compounds that I guess Dow took the patent on, but eventually you were making the chemical compounds and the instructions on making of these products available to the public. Let's talk about that, if you will, sir.
Absolutely.
I was interested in. There is a potential, I guess, to make money from some of these, but instead you chose to offer them to the public. And what's behind that thought, sir?
The thought is that these materials that I have this knack of inventing are materials that are eventually going to be used in research. They'd be very valuable in research. They're not commercial items. They could be made commercially available, and indeed there are some sites on the Internet who sell these materials. But the thing is, the value is as a research tool. And that's a academic, medical thing of value down the line, making it radio labeled with this or...
I was going to add that Sasha made a decision many years ago before we met, and he said that he felt that when money got involved, as it usually does in these things, something happens to the purity of the research, and he felt that this was one thing he was just simply going to stay away from, in the sense of making a lot of money off any of these compounds, because his focus and his objective is to discover more about the human mind. So that was a decision made long ago.
Thank you, Anne. Perhaps I can address this question to you. No one wants our children doing drugs, certainly not without a doctor's approval. And I don't think anything other than the vendors of some of these products want adults even to use psychedelics in a willy-nilly fashion. And I hear a proper set and setting is important and to a successful ingestion of these products. And I want to ask, what might constitute that proper set and setting?
Oh, well, the set, I understand it to mean the mindset of the particular thing that you go into the experiment or the session with, the questions that you go in with, the things that you want to find answers to. Sometimes it's just wanting to look inside yourself and have some more insight into the things you're doing in your life. The setting is extremely important also, and that is the surrounding. If you are in a hospital room with white-coated people and no flowers, no plants, no color pictures on the wall, this is a very sterile environment, and it can and does affect the session and the effects of the drug. So the setting means the surroundings in which you do your session and the people with whom you do it, so that you can feel safe and you feel trust of them, and you can reach out and touch a flower. All these things are of immense importance because you're dealing with the human spirit. This is Sasha is the scientist in this, but I consider all these materials, all these compounds, to be spiritual tools.
Thank you for that. And there are studies, finally, after decades of being stifled, I suppose, for post-traumatic stress, people with cancer who are getting some of these products. Do you want to talk about that, Sasha?
Yeah, actually, there are two or three, or more than that, four or five research projects that have been approved by the federal government, both the DEA and the FDA, and the research advisory panel of the academic institutions where the work is being done, on both MDMA and on psilocybin, and the treatment of the anxieties associated with having terminal cancer. And the work is being done with other people who are in the same medical crisis situation but are given placebo, to see if there's any positive value in these psychedelics in letting a person relax or live with his anxiety, or even dispel that anxiety a little bit. So far, the experiments have been going on, and they look quite promising.
Thank you. Doug Valentine, he was a guest here. He wrote a book, Strength of the Wolf, and he talked about the safe houses where many people were given access to psychedelic drugs, perhaps even controlled by the CIA. Have you heard of anything along that line, sir?
There's been quite a bit of work that had been done through the Edward Arsenal and through the government things in the use of drugs. Often, and this is back in the 1950s, where they would determine the possibility of these drugs being weapons of war, being weapons of psychological disruption in the enemy, and they actually used their own people as subjects, sometimes with and sometimes without their knowledge. It was an effort to find out if there could be things along the line of LSD, along the line of these various strychnines and psychedelic phenethylamines, that might be of value in obtaining information or in controlling the enemy, so to speak. That work was done pretty much in the 50s, and to my knowledge, it is, if it's still going on, it's not being made public.
Thank you. According to the New York Times article, between you two, you have done these compounds perhaps a total of 6,000 times. And what I find...
That's a little heavy.
It's a little heavy. Okay. Well, again, that's the New York Times for you, right? but, you know, given, I mean, I've done them 300 to 400 times myself, but what I find compelling is that at your age, you are 79, sir?
79, yes.
Yes, sir. And you're still inventing, still cogent, still functional, still an ongoing member of society.
I hope so.
I think so.
And I guess that kind of shows that there's no logic to these laws that would prevent use of these compounds.
I think a very excellent example we'll be seeing in about a week. We have to go over to Switzerland and see Albert Hofmann,
yes,
who
sir?
Is not a stranger to this area at all, the inventor of LSD and the first synthesizer of psilocybin. And he just went through his 99th birthday. And we'll
say hello
to him.
As far as we know, Albert Hofmann has only one or two problems, and say his two knees, which are giving him trouble. But beyond that, he is still mentally sharp and doing fine.
Well, I want you all to know that I sent him one of my promo packets with an invitation to appear on this show, and I hope you'll give him a kind word.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Now, I wanted to ask in regards to, you know, the layperson out there, would it not be better? I know it would be better. Let's talk about the fact that prohibition makes it where a person can't know the dosage or even the content of the product they tend to buy on the black market.
Well, this is one of the most serious problems associated with the idea of prohibition, is that you cannot verify, you cannot have any way of documenting not only the strength of, but even the identity or the purity of what you have been, you have bought illegally. And I think this is one of the big prices we have to pay for the war on drugs. You do not know if you have a hazardous material, a dangerous material, a misrepresented material. And I think there should be, as there is with the drugs that are still legal and have been made legal, such as the repeal of prohibition, of having a testing facility available to you in which you can find the material, what it is, how pure it is, the amount of material that's present, and eliminate the risks associated with the unknown.
Something that an organization called Dance Safe used to do at raves. And they could only do so much, but they at least could tell the young ravers, you know, whether they did or did not have MDMA, which is, you know, the real name of ecstasy. Because most of what is sold as ecstasy has either very little or no MDMA in it. And so saying that when you hear that ecstasy has damaged somebody or given them trouble or even killed them, this tells you nothing because we don't know whether there is any MDMA made as part of the tablet. So this means no quality control whatsoever over any of these drugs.
Now, I've heard it said that, you know, they try to tally the number of deaths, if you will, per year that from these psychedelics. And I heard it said that they think maybe 2 overdose deaths in a given year from ecstasy. But again, as you say, they don't know if that's in fact what the person took.
Sometimes the damage, the medical damage associated with the drug is associated with a physical event, such as falling downstairs or being in an automobile accident with someone else driving. And if they find the drug in the person, then they associate the damage with the drug, even though the drug may have had no direct action on the leading to the accident.
All right. I tell you what, if you will, we take a midpoint break, and this is going to be a minute and 20 seconds, and the last 30 seconds is what we call our name that drug by its side effect, and I want to see if we can, I know I won't fool you guys, but if you will catch the last 30 seconds of this, all right?
Okay.
Thank you. Here we go.
So what's that you're holding? The Controlled Substances Act. Controlled Substances Act. Brilliant. What you do with it? Well, I found a way to incarcerate 1.6 million Americans every year. Can you arrest them in their own homes, wherever they are? Yes! Arrest people wherever they are! Brilliant! What else are you working on? Claiming that marijuana is more dangerous than crack! More dangerous than crack! Brilliant! Brilliant!
Prohibition, the drug trafficker's dream. Enjoy it everywhere.
Brilliant!
The Drug Truth Network programs, Cultural Baggage, and the 420 Drug War News fight daily to restore dignity and truth to our society. Please support our efforts. Visit drugtruth.net. It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Increased blood pressure, dizziness, dry mouth, sweating, nausea, vomiting, delusions, paranoia, mental stimulation, and a sense of heightened understanding. Synesthesia, hearing colors and seeing sounds. Time's up. For the answer to this drug approved by the Native American Church, let's ask the renowned chemist, Sasha Schulman.
All right, were you able to name that drug?
Oh, it's the odds you're dealing with peyote or mescaline.
Yes. Indeed, indeed it is. And I wanted to talk to you about that. From my experience, I found that mescaline to me was the, somehow, despite the vomiting and the nausea, was the cleanest of the lot. And I wanted to ask you, how great a variance is there between these compounds? Are they all somewhat similar?
Oh, no, no. They can be very, very different. Mescaline, for example, in almost in everybody leads to nausea early in the process. And yet, the way it's taken by the people in the Native American church, they don't swallow a pill and then wait for the things to happen. They consume peyote over the course of an hour, two or three. And hence, the body builds up the level at a slow rate, and there's almost never nausea. So it's not just the nausea is intrinsic in the compound, but it's the compound and how it's taken and the environment in which it's taken is very, very important. The mescaline was my first experience, and I think Anne's first experience, too. We both had You had the peyote and I had the mescaline. This was many years before we met.
Yeah. It was an extraordinary day, and I put it down as well as I could remember it in, I think it was our first book. And I remember it still.
Well, speaking of your books, let's talk about them. You have a couple of, and I'm not sure I know how to pronounce them. Is it Tikal?
Pikal and Tikal.
Okay, and please tell us what's contained in those books.
Well, Pikal, the first of the two books, was published about 14 years ago. It's now in its fifth printing. It's still selling quite steadily. The letters P-I-H-K-A-L stand for phenethylamines I have known and loved.
All right.
And in there, I have the first half of the book is the love story, how Ann and I met and how we got to explore things together. And the second half of the book is the chemical story, in which I present about 180 phenethylamine psychedelics, how they're made. There's just all in the passive voice, no promotion of any kind, just merely the facts involved. And then give the estimate of the dosage that we have found to be an adequate, the range of dose range, and the types of effects to expect, side effects to expect, and then commentary on it. So the total of about 700 or 800 pages of a lot of information. The second book, Tikal, are tryptamines I have known and loved. That came out, six or eight years ago. And it is a comparable parallel book, but using tryptamines, the materials along the 5-methoxy-DMT and DMT and psilocybin, psilocin, and LSD.
And in the second book, the first one had quite a lot of loving and drug experience stories. In the second one, I put as much as I could off the therapeutic aspect of the use of these drugs, because some of them, not all of them, but some of them are extremely useful in psychotherapy.
Now, in my youth, I experimented with MDMA. I found it to be, to me, less than satisfactory. I think that's at least quoted in the New York Times, that it did not take you the full nine yards, so to speak. And
that's on Sasha's part, yes.
Yeah.
So that, yes, it's more, it's as much a stimulant. It's not really a psychedelic drug at all. It's a stimulant, but also it has this knack of dropping the barriers around you and letting you communicate not only with others but with yourself. And that's sort of the direction that it's used in therapy to a large measure.
It has an almost magical ability to allow you to see all the bumps and mistakes and dark sides and the parts of yourself that ordinarily you really don't want to look at. And to see all this and yet at the same time to know that you are an absolute treasure.
And to know, be able to recall all that has happened.
Yeah, there is no amnesia associated with it, but it is one of the most profound experiences that a lot of people have ever had, and it's of inestimable value in psychotherapy if a person's self-image and self-respect has been damaged.
Now, insofar as I don't know the situation involving the black market, I want to get back to that for a second. That we have cycled and recycled these rumors and innuendos about marijuana, about hard drugs, soft drugs, psychedelic drugs. But an instance that comes to mind, Dr. Ricarte and the fact that he used methamphetamine to claiming it was MDMA, and then took that evidence to Congress and got laws passed.
Well, you have to be fair to him. He did not know that that's what was happening. Apparently, the labels on the MDMA bottle and the methamphetamine bottle got reversed, and we have no idea how.
Okay, but I mean, that's still representative of the type data that goes before Congress, like they did with marijuana. And it's, go ahead, sir.
No, I was going to say, you're very right. You do not give positive things on the floor of Congress about the use of psychedelic drugs.
Yes.
You give negative things. You always emphasize the risks, the damage, and in essence try to justify the prohibition and make it more effective, which actually makes it less effective, by increasing the penalties, which increase the flow of economics associated with it. If you could only move all of this drug sale, drug confirmation into the pharmacy where it belongs, and let the scientific community evaluate, let the research community evaluate the risks and the positives, and speak about them openly, I think we'd have much less of a problem with drug use.
Let me ask you this. Given the circumstance, the change that is apparently happening with getting FDA approval and DEA approval for these studies, will that not, once the viability, the usefulness of these products is proven once again, force to take these off of the Controlled Substances Schedule 1?
I don't think at all. You see, you must remember that the whole element of politics associated with drugs is that of money, that of control, that of power. And I do not believe that the DEA will ever accede to the fact that there is a value here, because it would in essence decrease their control of they lose power.
And they'd lose their jobs.
And they lose their jobs.
That's true. We spoke earlier of the fact that you're still working in the lab, still inventing, still creative. Tell us a bit about your current work. What are you up to, sir?
Well, right now I'm involved in a new line of tryptamines, appear to be very interesting, and I want to explore them in my own quiet way.
Yes, sir.
I rather suspect they will be quite potent and have a fair amount of visual properties, changing the way things are seen. And I'm just not up to where I can publish it yet. The material is just beginning to accumulate. But my very great hopes is to be able to get out a paper or two very shortly that will either that or put it in the back of the third book.
Sasha is working very hard on a book that he alone is writing. Tell him about that.
Yeah, that is a book that is written on the format of the Merck Index. I call it the Psychedelic Index, in which I wish to handle all the drugs that are known to be psychedelic that would probably have been tried but not taken high enough to find out, or that are structurally closely enough related that they are probably going to be psychedelic drugs. And then, in a passive, objective voice, refer to the melting points, the synthetic things, and the pharmacology that's known, and the biochemistry that's known, and the legal status. All of these things documented. And at the moment, I have about 800 chemicals in the book, and it'll be probably around 1,500 pages. But I want to get that done. That's my highest priority right now.
Thank you, sir. Sir, I know you write an ongoing column for cognitiveliberties.org. If you will, tell us a bit about that. It's an interaction where people write you questions and you respond. Tell us what they might find on that site.
Well, what I do there, I'm given about 100 to 150 questions a month, and I try to write one or two answers to the questions, so there's quite a bit to choose from. And I try to find those things in which there is not as much factual information in the public domain as there should be. And actually find the answers, find the documented comments, and make them available to the questioner in a way that he will be able to answer his own needs. The thing I always have to avoid, and it's very, very important to avoid, is giving any help to a person who may wish to commit a crime. This makes you in a very awkward place, so I have to be very cautious not to tell people why their chemistry is not going, but to tell them this is the area that is to be watched out for in a given drug.
I touched on this earlier. In that column, a gentleman asked you, should he work? You indicated that the gentleman should work in a country such as Switzerland, where research of this nature is considered a medical matter and not a legal one. Are we returning to a dark age? I mean, honestly, I feel the science seems to be cloistering itself even more.
You use a strange word, return. I think we are very definitely entering into and getting into a very dark age. There is more and more people are acceding to the losses of freedom, the losses of information, the losses of education. They are saying, well, if it makes us safer, we'll go along with it, because we must have safety above all. And I think just the opposite. We must have independence and freedom of thought above all. And that is where I am very, very uncomfortable with the direction that our current government is going.
But as the optimist in the family, I want to point out that I've been seeing for the last year or so a very gradual but very definite change in the media, in particular in regard to, you know, whether there should be research on these materials. And there's been more mention of the psychotherapy. And the FDA is allowing some of this research to go ahead. And I feel that very quietly there is beginning to be a change, and I'm hoping it's going to continue.
Oh, bless your optimism, man. I don't quite feel that.
I want to thank both of you for taking the time to visit with us today here on Cultural Baggage. We've been visiting with Alexander, Sasha Shulgin, and his wife, Anne, and I do appreciate you so much joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll do it again.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, y'all.
Smart Politics, Bad Budgets, Part 1. The Bush administration released its budget recently. The good news is more money is going into drug treatment. The bad news is the details. The money will be put into treatment vouchers and into finding new treatment clients, but not into expanding treatment service availability. The Bush budget expands drug court funding. More middle-class, white, first offenders will have the chance to get through the system without a criminal record by spending 6 months in drug treatment with drug testing instead of 6 weeks in jail. The Bush budget also expands something called SPURT, Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment, in which people are screened for drugs when they go to a community health center, school health clinic, occupational health clinic, a rural health clinic, a hospital, or an emergency room. If drugs are found, the individual will be referred to treatment. Good news for treatment providers, and especially faith-based organizations which sponsor drug treatment programs. Bad news for the millions of people who sometimes use marijuana in a non-problem way. For the Drug Truth Network, this has been Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Next week, our guest will be Roger Goodman. He's the director of the King County Bar Association's Drug Policy Group up in Seattle. They're going to have a special report issued, and what I'm told, there's even going to be a bill presented to their legislature to allow for the state to control the distribution of illicit drugs rather than handing it off to criminals who don't mind selling to our children or selling us stuff that we don't know what's in that bag, right? I want to thank a couple of new stations who joined the Drug Truth Network, KBRW up in Barrow, Alaska, and KGLU in Girdwood, Alaska. I also want to welcome The Journey Online, the Christian radio station that's now carrying the Drug Truth Network programming as well. My friends, it's really up to you. This drug war ends when you decide. It ends when you bother to write that letter to your congressman, to your local papers, and you dare to speak the truth about this matter. There's no one on the other side willing to discuss this problem on the Drug Truth Network or in any public venue. And as always, because of drug prohibition, my friends, I remind you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
On behalf of the Drug Truth Network affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for the Unvarnished Truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.